Hanukkah is now in about 2 weeks. I want to start discussing Hanukkah over the next couple of weeks. I guess to get us back into the Hanukkah mood and the Hanukkah story, we know Hanukkah was considered, you know, the epic battle between the Jews and the Greeks, which we've used symbolically, we've discussed many times in the past, that symbolically every single holiday is not just a one-time battle which was fought and won, but it represents something which is symbolic of a historic battle, a historic struggle. And the struggle between the Jews and the Greeks wasn't only that one time during Hanukkah, but something which lasts this very day. And I'll explain what that means as we go on. The setting of the story was, it was the time of history after the conquest of Alexander the Great, where Greek culture had been spreading throughout the entire Europe, and even into the land of Israel, where the Jews were at the time. This is during the times of the Second Temple. And the culture of the Greeks, you know, their ideals, their... everything which they stood for in terms of, Greek society is something which we base so much of modern Western culture on. Science, architecture, mathematics, beauty, philosophy, much of it is based in ancient Greek society. And these ideas were spreading around the world like wildfire. I mean, Alexander the Great was the one, I think, we attribute to spreading it around militarily. He militarily brought Greece all around. But once he entered into certain countries, the culture really caught on. And many, many Jews were enticed by Greek culture. But this was something unique in history, because the Jews were never really enticed. I mean, there wasn't really such thing as, there wasn't much culture before this. There were non-Jewish societies around, and Jews at times were enticed by idolatry. But in terms of the intellectual accomplishment, in terms of beauty and science, and things that we would refer to as culture, they didn't really exist that much for the Greeks. Everything we would call cultural activity really came after that point. The Jews weren't necessarily enticed by pagan culture before this. They were enticed by idolatry for other reasons. But it wasn't the culture behind it. It wasn't the intellectual stimulation they got from idolatry. It was more of some sort of religious fervor that came from the idolatry. But the battle we had, the struggle we had with the Greeks, was a different kind of struggle. And as to put it more into modern terms, you know, the Jews were living in Eastern Europe 100, 200 years ago, let's say in Poland. So very few Jews were enticed by the Polish peasants. The Polish peasants were typically people who would drink and were violent and, you know, did not treat the Jews very nicely. And no Jew ever said, "I wish I could be a Polish peasant." No one ever said that, because who wants to be a Polish peasant? You know, we had to deal with them. You know, we had to deal with them trying to kill us and trying to persecute us and stealing our money and things like that. But none of us ever had a drive or desire to become Polish peasants. It just wasn't something which appealed to us. One of the big challenges of Greek culture in terms of the story of Hanukkah was that it was a very appealing culture. The people were they're good people, they're sophisticated, there's a lot of intellectual accomplishment. There's something which is very enticing to us as Jews. Jews are people, we're the people of the book, because we appreciate wisdom. And Greek culture really tried to promote wisdom and beauty throughout the land. It's something which is very appealing to us. The problem is, when the cultures around are too enticing for us and are friendly, even when they're kind of hostile towards our beliefs, we often fall prey to that culture. So at the times of the Greeks, the Jews, there are many, many Jews who became Hellenists, because the Greek culture was very appealing and it sucked us in. And we had to put aside our beliefs to join into their culture. The Greeks said, "We're very happy to accept you. Please join our society. You can come to our university. You can study science philosophy with us. You can join the Olympics, whatever you want. Just put aside all of your antiquated ways and your superstitious beliefs and all of these ancient things that you stick to from your Torah." Because that, for them, wasn't something that fit their culture. That wasn't scientific, that wasn't intellectual, that's something they felt was more superstitious and ancient and antiquated. And they said, "You could become a Greek, but forget the Torah, forget Jewish values. That we can't stand for." And that was the struggle which happened prior to the Hanukkah story. So based on that struggle, a small group of Jews rose up against the Greeks. These are the famous story of the Maccabees, the Hashmonaim family, and they waged this battle and actually won the battle. It was a very difficult, long, violent battle. Many people died. And when you hear the Hanukkah story, we kind of miss a lot of the historic points of it, because we hear the story about the candles burning in the temple, which was a miracle which happened within the story. But the actual battle was a long, grueling, bloody battle. It wasn't so simple that the Jews would overcome. They did overcome at the end. That was a very difficult time.
How long did it last?
I think historians say it was over 20 years. I don't have the exact numbers, but I think it was an over 20-year battle. The miracle of the oil, I think, happened even kind of within those, didn't happen at the very end, happened within the years, to my recollection. But we fought. You know, the Maccabees and their supporters stood up and fought against the Greeks, because not because the Greeks were threatening us physically, because they're threatening us spiritually. They were trying to assimilate us and entice us by their culture. And that group of Jews said, absolutely not. You know, we have to stick to our values, to our Torah, to what we stand for, and we can't let other cultures influence us in ways that draw us away from God. So that was the story of Hanukkah in a nutshell. But to me, the underlying message of Hanukkah, the broader message of Hanukkah, is the ability to stand up against the tides of assimilation, of cultures around us which try to suck us in and draw us away from Torah values. The Jew has to have the strength, the strength of will, the stubbornness in some ways, to be able to stand up against culture around and say that even though your culture looks very enticing, I have the Torah, I have God, I have my values, and I'm not going to let you influence how I feel and how I think. To me, that's the broader lesson of Hanukkah.
Which is so relevant today.
Which is extremely relevant today, yes, I want to get to that. But in modern day America, it's extremely relevant, this message.
What do you think of the Amish Mennonites, those who hold their old ways?
Right. And it's interesting, you're making a good point, because you know, we try to strike a balance. I mean, Jews, we don't act like the Amish. We don't just stay in our own little bubble and ignore the society around, at least most Jews don't. And Torah value typically is that we should interact with society around us. It's part of this balancing act that we interact with society around, we're not going to be influenced by them. And that's part of the challenge that we have. So I want to discuss, I'm going to go through here just some examples throughout the Torah of people who had to do this. And we'll see this is a trait which is kind of built into the meshwork and to the fabric of what it means to be a Jew. It's not just something that comes up as a modern day struggle, but really we'll see that so many of our ancestors had to deal with these issues in the Torah itself, and that's something that we have the power to do as well. I just want to start off with an idea from last week's, this expression, right, Vayishlach. It says in Vayishlach that Yaakov is leaving from the house of his uncle Lavan and coming back to the land of Israel. And Yaakov is scared because now he has to encounter Esav. Esav, 20 years back, had wanted to kill Yaakov, and Yaakov had to flee. Now, 20 years later, they have not talked in 20 years. Yaakov is not coming back to Israel, and he finds out that Esav's coming to greet him. And Yaakov is scared for his life. So the Torah says that Yaakov has to, he prays to Hashem to save him from Esav's clutches. And the prayer that he says, Atilini ninom yad achiv yad Esav, please save me from the hands of my brother, from the hands of Esav. So many commentaries point out this double language that Yaakov used. He says, from my brother, from Esav. And many explain this, you know, in different ways, but it's the same underlying point, which is that Esav comes to attack us in two different forms. Esav, it was known to be a wicked, evil person. And first and foremost, Esav comes to attack us physically, to try to kill us. Esav said, I'm going to kill Yaakov. In Parshas Toldos, Esav actually says that, I'm going to kill Yaakov. As soon as my father dies, I'm going to go kill Yaakov. That's what he says. And if you wanted to expand this to Jewish history, ever since we've been exiled from our land, non-Jews have risen up against us to kill us physically. As we've experienced in the Holocaust, and in pogroms, and with the Spanish Inquisition, and so many times in history, there have been non-Jews who come to try to actually exterminate us. So Yaakov says, save me from Esav, means save me from the wicked human being who wants to kill me. But when Yaakov says, please save me from the hands of my brother, Yaakov's alluding to another attack. Yaakov is saying that sometimes Esav approaches you like a brother. He's friendly, he's warm, he's welcoming. He says, please, let's be good friends. Let's rekindle our relationship. Just come with me, we'll spend time together, and we can live out the rest of our lives in harmony. That's what Esav says. Now, Esav is somebody we know is deep down is rotten. And there's nothing good about Esav. So Yaakov was equally as scared, or maybe even more scared, that Esav would approach him as a brother and try to reconcile the relationship and to make up. And why was Yaakov scared? Because then Esav's going to try to influence Yaakov to drop his values and drop the ways of the Torah and do things which are more in terms of Esav's values. That's what Yaakov was scared of. So he says, save me from my Esav, evil Esav, save me from my brother. If he comes to me as a brother, as a loving brother, save me from that. I'm scared of that as well. And the truth is in the story, it's what happens. You know, Esav, if you read the story in this week's Parsha, they seem to make up. Esav says, come join me in my home in Mount Seir. And Yaakov says, well, you know, I got a lot of kids. It's hard to travel. You go ahead. I'll catch up later. That's what Yaakov says. And he never caught up. That's what happens. But Yaakov's able to avoid that. Because Esav tries to invite him to come live side by side. But the problem is Yaakov understood if I live near Esav and I'm friends with Esav, Esav's going to influence me to negative ways. Negative, whether it be in action, whether it be in thought. But I'm going to be influenced by Esav's ideas, his culture, and I can't have that. So Yaakov prays to Hashem, save me from Esav coming to me as a friendly brother. And at the end of the story, Esav attempts that attack, and Yaakov is able to avoid it by saying, you go ahead, I'll catch up later. And he's able to brush him off. That's what happens in the story in the Parsha. So we know this is a challenge we've had through history. We've had those non-Jewish nations who come to kill us, but also we've had those nations that have come to influence us. And as much as we can appreciate, you know, society around us, and we can appreciate non-Jews and what they stand for, we can't have them pull us from Torah values. And that's always going to be the balance we have to be able to strike and to overcome. So I want to just go through different examples in the Torah about where we find this occurring and how we can draw strength from it. So really, we'll start from the beginning, from Abraham. Abraham, we know, is referred to as Abraham the Ivri. The word Ivri, Hebrew, we're all called the Hebrews, right? That's where the word Hebrew comes from, Abraham the Ivri. And one interpretation of Ivri, of the Hebrew, is that the word Aver can mean the bank of a river. And the sages teach us that metaphorically, Abraham stood on one bank of the river, and the whole world is the other bank of the river. I mean, yeah, Abraham stood against the entire world. He was the first person to rise up as a monotheist and try to bring Jewish values, as it were, to the entire world. That's what Abraham tried to do. And he was called the Hebrew, the Ivri, because he was able to stand up against all society. If you think back through Abraham's youth, Abraham grew up as a pagan. His family was idolatrous. His father had the idol store, as we know, famous story. His father sold idols. And Abraham himself went to the temple to worship idols as well when he was a kid. That's what Maimonides teaches us, and that makes sense. His family was idolatrous. Abraham, as time went on, explored the world. He thought, and he discovered that there has to be one God, and his idols are silly. And at that point, he stood up against the entire society around him. Against his family, against his friends, against his parents, against the entire city, against the king of the land he was in, is what we're taught. And he stood for his values. And everyone was going against him. He was on one side of the river, and on the other side. That's the metaphor. He was the lone monotheist fighting against the whole world of pagans. That's who Abraham was. But he did not budge his principles. He held fast his principles to the extent he was thrown into a fiery furnace by the king, and miraculously was saved afterwards. But he said, I'm not giving up my principles. I don't care what you tell me. And Abraham emerged to influence all world history. Abraham is viewed as the father of all the world's major religions. You know, Abraham is viewed as somebody that everybody sees as an influential character throughout all of history. There was a National Geographic article I saw probably like 10 years ago called Abraham. And it discussed Abraham's influence on the world history. It was a fascinating article. But a majority of the world looks at Abraham as an influential person because he's able to stand up against the tide and promote monotheism to the entire world. And his strength of conviction was remarkable. I mean, he wasn't coming from anywhere. He did not have he didn't have any family supporting him or friends supporting him. He had no Torah at the time. This is before he had prophecy. He was able to do this. And just based on his own personal convictions, he stood up against all around him and stayed strong. That's Abraham. You move on to the next generation. So we had Rebecca. So Rivka was somebody who was brought up in really Abraham's homeland, Padan Aram, where Abraham came from. And Rivka is, it's pointed out in the beginning of Parshas Toldos. It says that Rivka, let me just read the quote to you. Make sure we get the quote right. So it talks about that Yitzchak was 40 years old when he married Rivka. And then it says, Rivka was the daughter of Bethuel, the Aramean, from Padan Aram, the sister of Lavan, the Aramean, and that's who Yitzchak married. So the Torah stresses her background. Her background was, she was the daughter of Bethuel, the sister of Lavan, and she was from the land of Padan Aram. So Rashi teaches us there in the Torah, Rashi says that, why are we getting all these extra facts about Rivka at this point? We already know this already. I mean, if you read the previous parsha, when we discover Rivka, we know who her father was, her brother was, and where she lived. But the Torah repeats this again. Why is repeating it? So Rashi teaches us, Torah repeats these facts to tell us that even though, this is telling us the praise of Rivka, that even though she was the daughter of a Rasha, of a wicked person, and the sister of a wicked person, and her homeland was full of wicked people, she did not learn from their deeds. And she remained pure and innocent, despite the fact that her family and everyone in her homeland was wicked. That's what Rashi tells us. So Rivka had this ability to stand up against all around her, her family, her parents, and her brother, right, her family, her friends, her homeland, and maintain her beliefs, despite the suspect that society around was very hostile towards that. And that's the praise of Rivka. It's an incredible testament to Rivka herself to be able to do that as a young girl growing up in Aram. But again, she is our ancestor. Rivka, she is one of our matriarchs. And she gives us the ability to stand up against those around us who are doing the wrong thing. You go to the next generation. You go to Yaakov. So we just read about Yaakov praying to Hashem to save me from Esav. But picture Yaakov's situation as well. Yaakov spent 20 years in the house of his uncle Lavan. Lavan was a wicked person. The same people we're talking about in Rivka's case, that was the same people in Yaakov's case. Yaakov went back to Rivka's homeland, around all those wicked people, to the house of his wicked uncle, who was somebody who was an idolatrous, he was a cheater, he was a liar, he was a con artist. He spent 20 years there, totally dependent upon his uncle. He worked for his uncle. He married his wives when he was there, and 20 years later he leaves. When Yaakov, in this week's parasha, when Yaakov finally leaves Lavan's house, so Yaakov tells us that I lived with Lavan for 20 years, and I kept all the mitzvos during those 20 years, and I did not learn from his evil deeds. That's what Yaakov tells us afterwards. So Yaakov was able to spend 20 years in an environment with no support, no family, no friends, no rabbi, nobody who's going to help him maintain his Jewish beliefs. And he emerges saying, I did not learn one iota from my uncle. You know, I was able to maintain myself in my spiritual bubble, in some sense, throughout all that time. Yeah.
I read somewhere, though, that he went to stay with Shem and Ever before he went there.
Beforehand, yes.
Yeah, so he wouldn't, you know, so with these, you know, strangers.
Right, I actually want to get to that a little later. That's an important point. No, it's fine. That's a good point. But that's Yaakov. So yeah, Yaakov, and for us, it's also it was a superhuman feat. If we spent 20 years isolated from all Jews in some foreign culture, even if they weren't evil, just any foreign culture, how Jewish could we remain in 20 years with nobody around? No family, no friends, no Torah, no books, no nothing about Judaism. 20 years straight. How Jewish would we be 20? Would we be 20 years later? And Yaakov was able to maintain all of his beliefs, 100%, not learn one idea, one thought from the culture around him during those 20 years. That's the testimony of the Torah about Yaakov Avinu, about Yaakov. And again, Yaakov is our patriarch, and anything Yaakov does is passed down to us through our in our DNA, in our spiritual and physical DNA. And therefore, that he should give us the strength as well, that through these difficult times when we're around people who are hostile towards our beliefs, we should be able to maintain what we believe in and to overcome it. That's the story of Yaakov. So he was able to cling to the lessons of his father Yitzchak, his grandfather Abraham, through all those 20 years, despite the fact that nothing around him at all accommodated his beliefs. Let's move on to the next generation. You got Yosef. So Yaakov had a son, Yosef, his 11th son, and we know Yosef is the one who was sold to slavery in Egypt. And in Yosef's mind, for all he knew, he was cut off from his family for good. He didn't know that things would happen, his family would come take him back. No, in his mind, his brothers rejected him. His brothers almost killed him off. They sold him to slavery, and that's it. He's done. He's never going to go back and see his father again. He's never going to be able to rejoin the Jewish people. That's Yosef's mindset at the time. But yet, we know that when Yosef is in Egypt, whether it be as a slave, as a prisoner, or as the prime minister in Egypt, in all those positions, he maintained his beliefs he learned from his father Yaakov. We know that there's the famous encounter between him and the wife of Potiphar, who tried to seduce him, and he said, how can I dare to do such a crime? I'll be sinning to God. And we see that he maintained his allegiance to God, even in one of the most difficult challenges that a person can have. And afterwards, you know, 22 years later, when Yaakov finally comes down to Egypt to reunite with Yosef, so Yaakov says he's astounded by the fact that Yosef's able to... It was still loyal to the Torah and to God after all this. And Yaakov himself dealt with it in Lavan's house, And he sees his son dealing with it in Egypt. And it's even, for Yosef in some ways, it's even more difficult. Because Yosef, at the end of his stint in Egypt, he was royalty. Everything was at his disposal. He could have done anything he wanted. He could have eaten what he wanted, married who he wanted, no matter what. You know, he had total free reign over Egypt. And yet, you know, he made sure that he had kosher food. He was moral. He was ethical. He was honest. Everything he made sure everything was in place for him to keep to his beliefs. Again, even though in his mind he would never see another Jew again, right? That's what Yosef went through. So Yaakov is pleased and relieved and astounded by the fact that Yosef, after all those years, maintained his Jewish beliefs despite the culture around him. So that's Yosef. You got a whole more generation, right? Yosef had two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh. So we know on Friday nights there is a universal custom that parents bless their children. And the blessing that we give to our sons, it's a quote from Parshas Vayechi, in the end of Sefer Bereishis, we say that you should be like Ephraim and Manasseh. May God make you like Ephraim and Manasseh. So, what?
Sorry,
right, for the girls, right. But the why is it that we choose Ephraim and Manasseh as kind of like the paradigm of Jewish boys? We say, we tell our children, we don't say be like Abraham, or Yitzhak, or Yaakov, or Moshe, or Aaron, or King David. We say be like Ephraim and Manasseh. What was it about Ephraim and Manasseh that's so unique that we should bless all of our children, all of our sons, like Ephraim and Manasseh? So many answers are given to this. But one answer is along the lines we've been discussing. Ephraim and Manasseh were born into a royal family in Egypt. And Ephraim and Manasseh had all the doors of Egypt open in front of them. They could have gone to the greatest colleges, and they could have had all the money and all the power and all the fame and all the women, whatever they wanted they could have. They're Yosef's children. Yosef was in charge of all of Egypt. They could have done whatever they wanted. But despite the fact they're born into that society, into those privileges, into those opportunities, they rejected it all and they kept the faith. That's what happened. And when Yaakov came down to Egypt 22 years later and was reunited with his son Yosef, so Ephraim and Manasseh spent the time studying Torah with Yaakov. They didn't just say, I'm going to the Egyptian university, I'm going to be famous and wealthy, I'm going to be powerful, and I'm going to inherit the throne from my father. They said, we want to study Torah. That's what they said. So they were the first Jewish children born in exile. They were born out of Israel, away from their parent, their grandparents and great-grandparents who were loyal Jews. And even though they could have assimilated very easily and become totally affluent, powerful Egyptians, born to the royal family, they chose to remain Jews and to remain loyal to their beliefs. So they become the model for all Jewish children throughout eternity, that we want our children to have that strength. That despite the enticing culture around us, and despite the opportunities that are there to leave Judaism, you should remain loyal to our faith, loyal to the Torah, loyal to God, remain strong, and disregard all the other enticing opportunities around. So that's part of the reason why we bless our kids with like Ephraim and Manasseh. So we see that the first five generations of Jews all had to deal with these struggles, and all of them overcame it with flying colors. That's what you see in the first five generations of Jews. Abraham, Rivka, Yaakov, Yosef, Ephraim, and Manasseh all had to deal with these challenges, and all of them overcame. And again, as you mentioned before, we know that anybody who's considered a patriarch or matriarch of the Jewish people, three patriarchs, four matriarchs, that means that we have what they did, we have in our blood. And the power that they had and the strength of will that they had to remain Jewish, that's something that we have the ability to do as well. There is a, on Sukkot, we have the custom of doing of Hoshanos. We walk around with the little Esrog and the Shul, and every day you say a different list of different praises of God or requests called Hoshanos. So one of the Hoshanos we mention, we say, Hoshana Om Ani Choma, Hoshana. God, you should save the nation that is a wall. Om, the nation that says, I am a wall. So what does it mean more the nation that says, I am a wall? So it's really, it's based on a verse in Shir HaShirim, the Song of Songs. And it says in Shir HaShirim, Im Chomahi, if she is talking about, it says we have a sister, and our sister, if she is a wall, Nimla Tiroth Kesef, we can build upon her a palace of silver. Vim Devasi, if she's a door, we'll put upon her a plank of cedar. Very strange verse. What does it mean? If she's a wall, we can build upon her a palace of silver. And if she's a door, we can put upon her a plank of cedar. Very, very strange, abstract verse. So Rashi says that it's a metaphor to the Jews. And the metaphor they're talking about is the following. If our strength of faith in God and our fear of God is for us like an iron wall surrounding us, I mean, we don't let in other cultures, we don't assimilate, we don't convert, we don't let other cultures impact us, so we build a wall around us. So then you could build upon us a silver palace. And on that, Rashi explains, it means that on a nation like that, God can build up Jerusalem, the temple. I mean, that is the ideal image of a Jew, is that we should walk around as if we have a wall surrounding us to make sure that we don't assimilate. But if we're doors, what do you mean we're a door? A door is opening and closing all the time. Anything can come in, right? If you're a door, and you let in all the culture around you, let in all the influences of non-Jewish cultures that try to pull us away from the Torah, so then what goes upon that? So Rashi says it's a rotten, wormy plank of wood. That's all you can put upon that. Because it's not strong. You know, if we're so easily persuaded by other cultures, and we're not strong and loyal to God in our beliefs, so then you can't build upon that. That's not a nation that God can build upon. But if we're people who are like walls, and we make sure that nothing gets in which is not within Torah, the values of Torah, and the ethics of Torah, so then upon that, God can build an amazing nation, an amazing city, His holy temple, that can be built upon that nation. That's how Rashi explains this verse in the Song of Songs. So the Jews are called the nation that says, I am a wall. Because that's how a Jew has to be. We have to make sure that we surround ourselves with these symbolic walls to be sure that all that comes in to influence us is that which is in line with Torah values. That's the idea of being a wall. The just this idea of a wall, so we had it also, yeah. Well, that's referring literally to the courtyard of the temple. That's what it's referring to.
Oh, well, this is...
Okay. Yeah, I think I'm referring literally to the courtyard of the temple.
All the exiles
were coming. Right. When the Jews were first formed in the desert after they left Egypt, so God surrounded us with the clouds of glory, because that was symbolic of Jewish history, that even when we're not in the clouds, we should always make sure those clouds are there. And we have to be very selective about what comes in and what goes out. If you're just a revolving door, so then everything goes in and out, so you don't remain Jewish. But if you keep those clouds around, you make that wall around yourself, and then you can make sure that you're not going to be influenced by foreign ideas. The idea is mentioned again in the Torah over and over again. Bilam, the non-Jewish prophet who tries to curse the Jews, ends up blessing them. He says, they're Am Levadad Yishkon, their nation that dwells alone, and they don't, Vagoyim Lo Yischashav, they should not be considered amongst the Gentiles. Meaning that a Jew has to stand alone. We can't say we're just one of the other nations. Because no, we have to maintain our values, we have to maintain our ideas and our goals, despite those around us. We have to be individuals within society. And it says in the very end of the Torah, in Parshas Vezos Havracha, it says, V'ishkon Yisrael Betach Badad, that the Jewish nation shall dwell in security alone. In the commentary, the Or HaChaim writes, when are we secure? When we're alone, right? When we allow other influences in, we are not going to be secure. If we can be alone, we'd be secure. Not to offer any political messages nowadays, but when we are alone, we are secure, and if we're not alone, we're not secure. That's what he writes. So the question is, well, this is quite a challenge, and again, we said that the Torah certainly promotes interacting with other nations, but we have to make sure it's on our terms and that we're not able to be influenced by them. So we have to figure out, what is it that will allow us to remain strong and not be influenced? So I want to share with you an idea which is said from Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, one of the great Torah thinkers of the previous generation. So he writes in his work, Emes LeYaakov, he has a kind of a theory that runs throughout the entire book of Bereishis. And this is actually Fran was alluding to before. And this is the idea that we know that Noach, he had a son named Shem. And throughout the book of Bereishis, you find these references that the sages tell us that certain people went to study in Shem's yeshiva. So Shem, Noah's son, he taught Torah. Let's figure out what kind of Torah he taught. He had a son named Eber. And Shem and Eber had a yeshiva. And people throughout the book of Bereishis seem to be going to this yeshiva to study. And Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky asked the question, like, why are they going to this yeshiva? What are they studying? Right? An obvious question. And the question is even stronger because we find that Yaakov spends 14 years in this yeshiva prior to his exile to Laban's house. Now Yaakov had his father Yitzchak and his grandfather Abraham to study from. I mean, if you want to study Torah, who's the best person to go to? It'd be Abraham or Yitzchak. Not Shem and Aver, you would think. But Yaakov spent 14 years studying in the yeshiva of Shem and Aver. And this is prior to his exile to Laban's house. Later on, when the Torah tells us how Yaakov favored Yosef as his favorite son, so one point mentioned is that Yaakov taught all of the Torah he studied with Shem and Aver, he passed on to his son Yosef. Now, you would think he passed on to his son Yosef also that which he studied from Yitzchak or Abraham or others. Why is it that which he learned from Shem and Aver gets passed on to Yosef? So Rabbi Kamenetsky says a fascinating thing. He says that, let's start with Noach. And Noach was the father of Shem. Now Noach is somebody who lived in the generation of the flood. And Noach lived in a world that was wicked. To the extent they had to be eliminated, this world. And Noach was the one person to remain righteous in a world of evil, wicked people. So Noach obviously had the skills to maintain his beliefs and his values despite the society around him raging against him. So Shem is the one who picked up on that from his father Noach. Shem also lived through the generation of the flood. He's somebody who emerged from the generation as a righteous person. He was saved in the ark as well. And he established a yeshiva to teach people how do you maintain your beliefs in the society around you when the society around you is going against you. His son Aver was somebody who lived through the Dor HaFlaga, the generation of the Tower of Babylon. Right? When everyone tried to rebel against God, and they built this tower, and God said, we have to come down and destroy this tower and scatter them about. He lived in that generation. And those people were all wicked. And he was able to maintain his values in that generation. So Shem and Aver had a certain expertise in this area. How do you maintain your values in a world which is hostile to your beliefs and trying to pull you away from what you stand for? So Yaakov, before he went to Laban's house, he said, I better get ready. Because I know if I spend 20 years in my wicked uncle's house, I'm going to be influenced. There's no way out of it. So he spent 14 years studying in this yeshiva to get the tools to be able to stand up to his uncle's influence. And that's what Rabbi Kamenetsky says. He says, furthermore, Yaakov understood that Yosef would also end up being an exile one day. So Yaakov taught his son Yosef all of these concepts, these values that he received from Shem and Aver. He taught them to Yosef. When Yosef went to Egypt and was there for 22 years by himself, that was what sustained him, was these lessons he learned from his father Yaakov. Right, that's true. So I want to try to address what the information may have been. We don't have a record of what the information was exactly, but I'll tell you my thoughts on it in a minute. But whatever skills and strength and tools we need to survive assimilation, survive foreign culture, Shem and Aver were able to teach. And Yaakov received it from them and passed it on to Yosef. And I would suggest that Yosef passed it on to his sons and friend Menashe. And that makes sense, that whole chain of people were able to stick to their beliefs in a hostile environment. All generated from the Torah studied with Shem and Aver. That's what I would suggest. So what do you study? I'm saying, what do you do? I mean, we live in a time that has this particular challenge. We know how many Jews out there, unfortunately, have assimilated. The assimilation rate is atrocious in modern American Jewish population. Intermarriage rate is terrible. And so many Jews have been influenced. And we understand why, because America is a very inviting society. People are friendly. A lot of things out there are very, very welcoming. And it's not all bad. Some of it's very positive. But a lot of it causes people to move away from their Jewish values and become fully American. And being fully American means that we'll assimilate into American culture and society, and we'll forget about our ancient, quote-unquote ancient beliefs. Those Jews who came over from Eastern Europe, whether before or after the Holocaust, but a large majority of them did assimilate. And if they didn't, their children did. And part of the culture of America, certainly in those times, was the melting pot, and you got to become American. And even nowadays, where America tries to have more cultural diversity, it's still very hard at times to maintain our values when all around us are not supporting those values. So what do we do? And just to question even ourselves, like, you know, all of us, everyone sitting here is obviously an affiliated Jew. You know, coming to this class obviously means that, and I know all of you, so I know that everybody here is a proud Jew. But how much of our outlook is really coming from a Jewish roots, and how much is coming from American roots? It's hard to know sometimes. You know, we grew up as Americans, and a lot of what we think in our routines and our thought processes made the American and not Jewish. It's not necessarily bad, depends what it is. But, you know, how much of it is coming from Torah values, how much is coming from American values? It's something we always have to check ourselves. You know, we have to make sure that wall is there and understand, okay, what's coming into my wall? You know, I can't let it be a revolving door. If what's coming in is a positive trait, I can take it. But if it's not a positive trait, then I have to make sure it doesn't affect me. So what do we do? So I would suggest, again, Rabbi Kamenetsky doesn't say it, I have no source to say what Shame Aver taught Yaakov. I don't know, right? But I would suggest that, I guess, three different areas that I think really help a person maintain their beliefs in a hostile society would be the following. Number one, it's the ability to be able to have a strong emunah, faith and perception of God. I mean, somebody who has a strong faith and perception of God in life, so no matter where you are, what you're doing, you know that I don't care about others, it's me and God, right? I don't need the approval of others, I only care if God approves of me. I don't need the support of others, I don't need to blend in with others, because what really matters deep down is, does God approve of my actions or not? There are many, many Jews, I've read many stories about Jews in, you know, in Soviet Russia, who spent decades in like work camps, things of the sort. And even though they're the only Jew in these work camps, they're able to maintain some semblance of a mitzvah observance throughout all that time there. Where did that come from? It's because their faith in God was so strong. They didn't care about the Russians around them screaming at them, yelling at them, and taunting them, and making fun of them. They didn't care about the commanders beating them. They didn't care, because does God appreciate, does God enjoy, does God approve my actions or not? That's the question they ask themselves. And if the answer is, God approves what I do, so I don't care what others do to me. That's a very high level of faith in God, but that's part of what we have to learn to be strong in our beliefs. I think a lot of that also has to do with being able to perceive God's providence over the world. To know that God runs the world, God runs the show. And for Yosef to say, the fact I'm here in Egypt, it's not a rejection from my family and from God, but Yosef can say that God wants me here, which he says. After the fact, Yosef tells his family that, you know, I was sent to Egypt, but it was all for the best. Because look, now you're here in times of famine, and I can feed you all. So obviously that shows us Yosef's thought process that entire time was that God wants me here for some reason. I know it's difficult, but I'm here because God has placed me here. And therefore the challenges that are coming my way are not because God has rejected me and that I should give in. It's because God wants me to deal with what's happening right now. If we're strong in that belief, that also helps us. And the third area I would stress would be the love of being Jewish. Meaning the love of Torah, the enjoyment of studying Torah, love of the mitzvot, the love of praying to God. Because if that's where you get your enjoyment, and that's where you get your kicks in life, as it were, so then the fact that society around you might be offering you other forms of entertainment or kicks or enjoyment, you say, I don't need that, because I'm very, very content and happy with my life as a Jew. Now every morning in the Siddur, there's a blessing we say, Baruch Atah Hashem Elokeinu Melech HaOlam, Shelo Asani Goy. Thank you, God, for not making me a non-Jew. That's not a politically correct bracha, trust me. You know, it's something which, you know, and there are Jewish movements out there, not Orthodox movements, that want to take it out of the Siddur because it's not politically correct based on modern times. But to me, that's an extremely important Jewish value, because we don't look down at non-Jews with disdain. We can appreciate non-Jews, but we have to be proud of being Jewish. And Jewish pride means that, you know, I understand that my values are different, but I don't feel secondary because of it. I feel proud of who I am. You know, I feel that, you know, I'm the one who's bringing God into this world. I'm maintaining morality and God's values in a world which doesn't know about these values. And I'm proud of who I am. So I'm not somebody, I don't feel like I'm second class now because everyone else is different. I say, no, I'm glad I'm not like them. I'm so happy to be Jewish. And not in a way which you know, and disgraces a non-Jew or puts him down, but in a way just showing my Jewish pride. That's what it's showing. So that, to me, that's the third area, the love of being Jewish, the pride of being Jewish, developing your own sense of enjoyment and pleasure in Jewish life. That means that I'm not going to be enticed by the things around me, because I'm totally happy and content with the way I live my life. So the story of Hanukkah is this fight. To wrap it up, you know, Hanukkah is the fight where you had a culture around that was a very enticing, beautiful culture. Something which is overtaking the world. It was this craze at the time. It was something which was sweeping the entire continent. And Jews had to make a choice. You know, Jewish life, mitzvos, Torah, was the opposite of what the Greeks stood for. Am I going to go with the flow around me and be sucked in by that culture? Am I going to maintain my beliefs, despite the fact I'd be looked at as weird, as antiquated, as not with it, as not cool, whatever, how I'm going to describe it? And many Jews, unfortunately, gave in. But there are those Jews who stood up and said, no, we're going to fight to the death to be sure this doesn't influence us. And that's what they did. Now, the symbol of Hanukkah is oil. The famous miracle in the temple happened with the oil. And oil has a quality that doesn't mix. Put oil in the water, it flows to the top. And to me, that's the symbol of Hanukkah is oil makes a lot of sense. Because we as Jews have to be that oil. We have to make sure that you can dump us into any society in the world, but we always are going to separate out. We're going to float to the top. And we're always going to remain separate. There's oil and there's water. And that's how you have to view it. So that's the symbol of Hanukkah, that we stay separate. And this is our challenge, I think, we have in particular in modern-day America as Jews. And it's something which was an epic battle fought at the times of Hanukkah. At that time, there was a victory, and we have to make sure we maintain that victory. So Hanukkah is the time of year where we have to really contemplate this concept and figure out how do we keep out non-Jewish influences, things that are, again, not just, I don't mean things that are not necessarily, that are good, I mean things that are anti the Torah, how to keep that out from Jewish life. That's the question. So we should be like that oil, and we should be able to separate out and maintain our pride in our image, our identity, despite the society around us.